Good afternoon. For those of you that missed us on the Geeks for Fans podcast, we are Game Buoy. Today we're going to be serving up in-depth video game conversation realness. With me today, as always, is my first mate, Slagkick.
Ahoy, mateys.
And the goal here is going to be for us to sort of have a blog for you to refer to. You're going to download our show from it. You're going to get relevant links to the topics we discuss here today. We'll have that address for you at the end of the episode. And I think we're going to get started with our news segment, affectionately called Oh My God News.
News. News. News. Oh My God News.
So, Captain Spike, what do you have for us on the news platter today?
So, I want to keep this light. I don't necessarily feel like we need to tell everyone in the internet about every post Joystick has made this weekend.
Yeah, because I hope people know how to read.
But there's a couple of things that I really feel like the mainstream press and the more popular blogs are missing. So the first thing I wanted to tell you guys about is that April 25th, so, you know, in a few weeks, Sega is going to be releasing the Sega Vintage Collection Monster World. This is, of course, noteworthy to me because for the first time in English, we're going to be seeing a release of Monster World 4. There's been a fan translation of this game. It was, you know, originally a Sega Genesis game, or, you know, Mega Drive for those of you so inclined. There's been a fan translation of this game that I believe Demiforce did way back. I would probably go so far as to say it's my favorite Genesis game. And I'm really bummed to see that more people aren't talking about this, because to me, I don't know how you feel about this, Sidekick, but I think that it's a great thing that publishers could be going back to the vaults, taking old games that never made it to English-speaking territories, and translating them to English and doing, you know, these sort of low-risk, high-reward digital releases.
Well, I mean, they've definitely been capitalizing on that sort of thing the past few years. I mean, you've seen Virtual Console doing sort of the same thing with some previously Japan-only titles, so, I mean,
Yeah, Sin and Punishment, in fact, which, as far as I'm aware, did well enough that they ended up making a Wii sequel.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't speak to as why the internet's just ignoring this. I mean, maybe because it's Monster World.
Yeah. Have you played any of the Monster World games?
I haven't. I can't say that I have, but
so
I'm familiar with the franchise. So I mean,
what I'm going to suggest to you personally and everyone out there on the internet, for some reason, this Monster World collection will not have Monster World 3, which I would dare say is probably the high point of the franchise. I'm going to suggest that you, Slagkick, and everyone out on the internet, download Monster World 3 off of Virtual Console or whatever. I don't know if it's maybe in one of those Steam packs of all those Genesis games that they have on Steam. And just give Monster World 3 a play. It's like someone played Zelda 2 for NES and decided to make an update. It's just side-scrolling 2D RPG realness.
Wow, that actually sounds pretty legit.
Let's see, so the second thing I want to talk about, and unfortunately we know very little of this at this time, but it's something I'm really excited about, is that the 3DS version of Epic Mickey 2, which has the subtitle Power of Illusion, is apparently going to be a sequel to Sega's classic, and I would say highly underrated, Castle World, insert noun, of Illusion games.
See, that excites me, because I played a pretty good amount of Epic Mickey, and I don't know, I mean, it's cute, but I just didn't think as a game that it was very cohesive. Now, I've seen the few screenshots that are available of Power of Illusion. It looks pretty great.
Yeah, it looks legit as hell.
And I saw, like, a screenshot with Uncle Scrooge, I'm like, yeah, I'm there. And I mean, for people who don't know me personally, Captain Spike and I are both pretty big Disney fans, so...
Yeah, no, we stand Disney pretty hard. And, you know, something else I'm really excited about, and you touched on it, is that of the screenshots we have, it looks like this is going to be kind of a Disney crossover game. Beast appeared in these screenshots. Peter Pan appeared. Scrooge McDuck. So, to me, it almost seems like they might be doing side-scrolling 2D Kingdom Hearts without all the Square Enix stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. I mean,
I love me my Kingdom Hearts. I really, truly, deeply do. I would not be opposed to having a second Disney crossover series that was less about belts and zippers and things.
True. And, you know, I'm just excited to see. I mean, we're going to really have to see how the gameplay ends up being. And, you know, really, kind of, once we find out more, it'll be kind of easier to see if our expectations are going to be met. But, I mean, I just have really fond memories of pretty much everything 2D Disney, whether it's going back to DuckTales on the NES or Aladdin on Genesis and Super Nintendo, really. So, you know, I even like that circus game starring Mickey and Minnie.
I'm sorry, I'm not super familiar with that one. Can you refresh me?
You know, the title's escaping me right now, but you had to go around and there were different costumes that you could wear.
Oh, are you talking about, was it a Magical Quest?
Magical Quest, yeah, I believe that sounds right.
You know, Capcom did that game, and they actually did a GBA port of it a few years back.
Did they really?
Yeah, it's actually quite superb. Yeah, I love those games.
Capcom, I mean, always did a superb job of for their Disney-related titles, I thought.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you mentioned DuckTales, and of course that's a classic. They also did that Chip and Dale
Chip
game.
Chip and Dale 1 and 2 were both fantastic.
Yeah, they did that kind of Mega Man-inspired Darkwing Duck game.
That Darkwing Duck game was superb.
Yeah, you know, the more I'm talking about these games, the more excited I'm getting for Epic Mickey Power of Illusion. If this game really does deliver on its promise, I think we're in for quite a treat.
Now, what studio is releasing Power of Illusion? Because that,
well,
I'm not familiar with.
It's going to be developed by Dream Rift. They were behind 2011's Monster Tail, which was a Nintendo DS game, which was a 2D game with really superb sprite work done in the Metroidvania style.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, in fact, there was some monster training element, too. So it's in good hands. They did some great things.
Yeah, I mean, because I figured that Capcom wouldn't be touching this. They're too busy doing Lord knows what.
Farming out their franchises to American studios and Canadian studios, more specifically.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm more excited about this than the Wii one, which I didn't bother to familiarize myself with because
yeah,
I was just too...
The Power of Two, I think it's called, because you can now play as a two-player co-op with Mickey and Oswald.
I don't know.
They're also doing ports of that to the HD consoles, so...
Are they?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be excited about it, but I thought Epic Mickey was really lackluster. I was not as impressed as I'd like to be.
It's not something that HD graphics is going to fix for me. It's just the gameplay was kind of jank, to be honest.
Well, it was really stale. I kind of felt like they did themselves a disservice releasing on the Wii. Not because I have a problem with the Wii. I actually think the Wii is a fantastic console. I think it has a lot of promise. I think it delivered on a lot of that promise. My problem is, Nintendo, as a developer, does the best 3D platforming games in the industry. I don't think anyone's going to argue me that, but, I mean, if you do, if you think, you know, Ratchet & Clank is better than Mario Galaxy, there are people who think that, then, you know, you're more than welcome to your opinion. But when you're competing with that tier of quality in 3D platforming, I don't think a game like Epic Mickey really meets the bar that's been set.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's easy to put out a good 3D platform game these days.
Yeah, and
I mean, it could be easy, but I mean, people just keep missing the mark again.
If they had launched on the HD Twins in the first place, they might have actually done a little better, I think, not competing directly against, again, the sort of cream of the crop of the platform, of the industry, really.
True, but I mean, I don't know. It wasn't anything to do with the visuals. I don't know if it's something that hardware limitations would...
Oh, again, I agree. I don't think the Wii was the problem because of its power. I think the Wii was the problem because of its competition on the platform.
True, but then if I was playing it on 360, I'd be like, shit, I'd rather be playing Mario Galaxy.
You know? Well, yeah. That's because you have
to. But anyways, regardless of my mixed feelings about the first Epic Mickey, I'm very excited about this.
There's one more thing I'd really like to talk about today. And I'm going to keep it short because I think probably we're going to talk about this in a future episode. It is so big. But news broke on Friday that Sega of America has initiated huge layoffs of its workforce. They put out an official statement that they're going to be consolidating their publishing business in order to focus on developing digital content and driving its existing IP. You can't see it, but I'm doing air quotes right now.
Yes.
And really what this means is that in the retail sector, from Sega for the next couple of years, I think we're pretty much only going to see Sonic the Hedgehog, Total War, Football Manager, and their licensed Alien games.
So, pretty much, when you're talking about the Sonic games, that means we'll get a good Sonic game every 4 to 5 years.
And that's being optimistic.
And then a bunch of really shitty Sonic games.
Yeah, we'll probably start getting more Sonic spin-off games of, you know, Sonic in the at the Olympics and what have you.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I think the only really good Sonic game that I played in the past, like, you know, maybe 2-3 years. Now, I didn't get around to Sonic Colors, which I heard was good, but
yeah, I actually thought Sonic Colors was superb.
I heard that was pretty good, but the only other one that I actually thought was pretty great was Generations.
Yeah, Generations, and you know, if you listen to our previous podcasts when we were still with Geeks for Fans, you'll know I actually thought that was one of the best games released in 2011.
Yeah, and I don't know how much time you spent with Sonic and Mario at the Olympics, the original one, because we're up to, this is going to be the third one, right, with
Summer
Olympics
so.
For London 2012?
Yep.
Because I didn't even touch Winter Olympics, because the first one was just like a really bad Wii Sports.
Yeah,
I didn't care for it at all.
I got it, I rented it from Gamefly, spent maybe 2 hours with it, and sent it back. It did nothing for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's something more significant that comes from this news, aside from the fact that we'll only be seeing shitty Sonic games. And it was something you were talking to me last night about.
I am scared to death about the future of the Bayonetta franchise.
Yeah, because at first I thought, oh, you know, maybe another studio can just purchase Platinum, but then you told me what?
Well, Sega owns the IP for Bayonetta.
As they should have, because it was great.
Yeah, it was great. My understanding, of course, is that ultimately they did make money off of that, but did they make enough money that it's worth the potential risk of losing money to make another one? Did they make enough money that it's worth risking basically a retail failure? Because you never really know at this point in the generation, and unfortunately, this generation, whether a game is going to sell well enough to justify how much it costs to make.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the thing is, if they did sell the IP, Capcom's not going to take it because, I mean, you have to look at the history of Platinum in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, they're formed primarily out of people fired from Capcom for releasing games that didn't, for making games that didn't sell.
I mean, what Japanese studio is going to take it unless they brought it to an American studio?
In which case, I mean, we do have, of course, you know, Platinum and Grasshopper both have done some work with American studios. It could happen, and I only bring Grasshopper up in this instance because I feel like they're sort of a similar boutique studio that does sort of edgy software development. But, you know, I think that they had a publishing deal with EA Partners for, was it Shadows of the Damned?
I believe so, yeah.
So, you know, I guess something like that is a possibility. I would love to see Capcom just their egos, buy the Bayonetta IP, and do a Bayonetta Devil May Cry crossover with Hideki Kamiya at the helm. Just, the man basically made this style of game feasible. He created Devil May Cry, he created Bayonetta, and I really feel like in an ideal world, this would be a perfect opportunity to sort of bring things back together.
Now, see, this might just be the gay man in me speaking, but I would love to see Nintendo buy it out. And I'm not just saying this for shits and giggles, but imagine imagine playing a Wii U Bayonetta game that implements dual Wiimote controls for guns and, like, almost a little bit of dance action on a balance board. It sounds, like, super gimmicky, but imagine if it was done right.
It would be super gimmicky. I wouldn't want it to be the primary mode of control for the game. As an option, I would play the shit out of it. That would be a great deal of fun.
Or even if it was just part of a franchise. I mean, if they bought the IP and they're like, oh, we can turn this into a dance rhythm game.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I mean, there's so much potential for the Bayonetta franchise that if it just totally fizzles out because of the state that Sega's in, that's going to be really disappointing.
Yeah, and you know, it is worth mentioning, of course, that they did specifically in their statement remark that they intend on focusing on digital. And maybe that just means that we'll see future games, like big, whole, entire games, be developed for, you know, download only. I don't exactly find that ideal, but I would buy a Bayonetta 2 as a download title if that was the only way to get it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would too, so.
So, I think we're going to talk more about this on a future episode of Game
Week.
Yeah,
this just has... I mean, we've had a lot of studios closing. We talked about some of them on Geeks for Fan.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing concern, and I really feel like we're starting to see sort of the shit hitting the proverbial fan.
And I think there's just more to say about that than we want to pack into this first episode. So
yeah,
we'll be revisiting that, definitely, because, I mean, if the gaming industry goes south in a bad way, what are we going to be talking about?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, it's just dick and fart jokes.
Yeah.
So, that's it for Oh My God News.
News. News. News. Oh My God News.
Next up, we want to get to sort of the meat and potatoes of this episode. Slagkick and I are going to talk about Mass Effect 3.
Multicolor endings!
Yes, we are going to specifically talk about the ending.
We just like to warn you, as much as we would like you to listen, if you are the type of person who does not want to be spoiled...
Get out.
We would ask that you please save this podcast and listen to it after you beat the game. Go beat the game, because it's a fantastic game. I'll let you get this started, so I don't just start rambling.
Yeah, if you are spoiler-phobic, you're adverse to spoilers, this is the point to bail out. I feel like we've given you enough warning at this point that we can talk about it.
Yeah, you know, maybe just go put on an episode of Archer, watch some RuPaul's Drag Race or something, and then come back to us once you've finished Mass Effect 3.
Yeah. So, I guess there's no real easy way to start this discussion. As everyone listening, probably knows, reaction on this thing has been really divided, so let me just dive right in. How did you feel about the ending as it stands?
You know, it's interesting because I've actually been pretty recent to the franchise. You know, I have to admit that I did not understand why BioWare got as much standing as it did from people we know personally, like good friends of mine, are like, oh, I'm playing my fifth playthrough of Dragon Age. And I'm like, okay, I'd rather be playing a different game instead of playing the same one five times through. Like, I didn't get it. I didn't have the history with Coder or anything else.
Baldur's Gate.
And I mean, I did, I think probably what got me interested in it was playing started playing just over the past couple weeks. That's pretty much what March was for me in gaming, was all Mass Effect. And I mean, I can clearly see now why this studio has so much love and why these franchises are so engulfing. Let me just preface this with the fact that I think that Mass Effect 3 is probably the best game of the franchise.
I am... Okay, we're in spoiler acceptable territory, so I can say this. I agree. I think the first 99% of Mass Effect 3 is probably one of my top 5 experiences of this generation.
Easily. I think it's just really polished. I know people complaining about it being dumbed down, but...
I thought it was really super well polished. I thought the writing was superb. I thought the voice acting was pretty much amazing.
That Freddie Prinze Jr. would have been a legit addition.
He absolutely sold me on James Vega. I was not excited for that character. Oh yeah, we really need a hot dog necked Gears of War looking motherfucker up in Mass Effect. No, I very much did not think we needed that in this franchise. But it's a testament to his voice acting and the writing of the character that ultimately I wanted to bring him with me on missions.
You know what I would have liked?
That having been said...
I just have to interrupt really quickly with a slight off-topic. We have Seth Green in the game, we got Freddie Prinze. Why couldn't they have gotten Sarah Michelle Gellar? I mean, it just seems like the natural thing to do when you got those two involved. But...
Well, nah, dude, they were busy getting IGN correspondents to do voice acting for them.
Please continue.
But I do have to say, that ending, I'm not super into it. I'm a huge stan for BioWare. I am a huge Mass Effect stan. And the ending as it stands is so hastily put together. It is so haphazardly designed. It's just sloppy. And as it stands, I can't really accept it, even if the underlying ideas I think are okay. And that sort of leads us to our next point.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that I didn't know what the ending was. I managed to stay spoiler-free for that, but I knew that it was polarizing. And when I first played through it, I was, like, having an ugly cry at the end, because I'm like, I mean, part of it just might have been saying goodbye to my shepherd. Even though, as we'll get into in a minute, maybe I'm not actually saying goodbye. And I think that if this had not been the age of the internet where everything is all over the place, and I had just seen that for myself and not been exposed to all of the holes in the plot and everything, I would have been like, oh my god, flawless. But then I realized, like, the choice I ended up making, because, I mean, if you're listening to this, you know, or you don't care to be spoiled, that it's basically what the internet's joking is that it comes down to what color of explosion do you want. And would you like to elaborate on that a little bit for those who may not have gotten to that point, but, you know, at this point don't care about being spoiled?
So, you have three options. There's the red option, which of course is referred to by the fandom as destroy. You have the
blue option, which is control. Where you assume control of all the Reapers.
Yeah, where you basically become what the elusive man wanted to become.
And then there's the option.
And then there's the option that I would call most polarizing. I've picked it myself, actually.
Because I didn't even think about this until someone pointed it out. Well, I mean, until the internet pointed it out to me. It wasn't anyone in particular.
The green option, of course, is referred to as synthesis, where you basically decide that everyone should be a mystical, happy, fairy combination of synthetic and organic life.
And I thought, I was like, okay, this is some Miyazaki realness. This is straight up Evangelion couture.
Yeah, well, you know, I saw it, and I was like, oh, this is...
I was like, how poetic is that?
This reminds me of the original ending, and I feel comfortable spoiling this because it's not the canon ending anymore. It reminded me of the original ending of Battle Angel Alita, which has a similar high concept ending. I was like, okay, this is cool. This, this fusion of synthetic and organic to save existence.
Do you know why I picked that option?
Why?
Because I made the Joker eating romance happen, and I was like, I don't want... Even though destroying the Reapers was supposed to be our goal, I thought that, oh...
Well, the Magic Star Child tells you that, you know, if you pick destroy all synthetics, even Shepard...
Including Shepard.
Will die. And, you know, all I could think was like, wait, but I have Legion, he's my bro, and I want him to die. And Edie, well, I encourage Joker to start banging her and fall in love. Like, I don't want to kill those people.
Wait, your Legion lived?
No, he died, but all of his gifts he gave sentience.
I guess that in the way that is Legion.
So. Well, yeah, right? Like, I really felt like I was indebted to Legion. I didn't want Legion.
Same
I didn't
here.
Want the Geth to die.
Legion. He was one of my favorite characters of the franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, I picked Synthesis, and initially it was like, okay, cool, that's great. I had a moment. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt like, you know, that was not really a great ending. I mean, okay, it solved the primary conflict, but none of the character-specific conflicts, none of the character-specific story beats really got addressed. And the more I read about it on the internet, because I, like many people, when I'm having a negative feeling, I check on the internet to see how other people feel about things. And I discovered, most interesting to me, and what got me into my current theory on the ending, I saw that the only way to get the secret ending was to rally the entire galaxy through the effective military strength system.
Which, and this is something that's pissing fans off, you either have to play that iOS game, which is terrible for
probably the worst game I've ever played.
Or you've got to play multiplayer, which, I mean, I just need to interrupt and say that I think the multiplayer is fantastic.
I love the multiplayer. But it's really the principle of the matter. It's a single-player game. You shouldn't have to play multiplayer.
And they had said that you wouldn't have to, so, I mean...
But, so I saw that to get this best ending, the one where, after everything happens, Shepard wakes up back on Earth, breathing.
I've got to actually... I mean, that's what the whole core behind this theory is. But, and, I mean, I do find this theory that you're about to explain... make a lot of sense, but I have to play devil's advocate. What if that is still kind of in play, but that breath we see is Shepard's last breath as opposed to him waking up?
Well,
has anyone
taking it to a metatextual place, we already know that that can't be the case because we're going to have DLC at some point.
That's true.
At this point, removed from the game, BioWare has said that Shepard's adventure will continue. So, prior BioWare saying that, I was sort of like, oh, well, maybe that's the end of Shepard. He somehow survived the fall from being in orbit to falling all the way to Earth, and then he's just gonna die, not on impact, but, you know, on the ground, whimpering, and not going out with a bang, but with his whimper. I also think that's a horrible ending.
Yeah.
But I would buy it. Instead, I, along with a great deal of people on the internet, are starting to buy into what is referred to as indoctrination theory.
And I just can't believe that. I mean, I think it speaks to the passion of the BioWare fanbase that they are so involved with the lore of this game. They are so aware of every little intricacy of the game that they were able to piece it together.
Basically, the argument is that most of the out-of-character moments you see, the decreased level of individual choice you have in this game over the other games, how weird and almost glitchy and out-of-place the ending is, that all of these are ultimately symptomatic of what is a subtle indoctrination of Commander Shepard throughout the third game. Of course, it seems really strange when you think about it, but once you start looking at the individual pieces, you have the Star Child at the end of the game, who looks just like the little boy from the beginning of Mass Effect, that you see playing with a toy Normandy
that
before.
Was cute, I have to say.
Yes, well, if he's representative ultimately of indoctrinating Shepard, it's also interesting to think of him as a puppeteer playing with a small Normandy. And, you know, we see this kid enter a building that gets blown up. We see only Shepard responding to him. We see him climbing into an air shuttle that also gets blown up by a Reaper. He's getting in that shuttle. There are other people getting in, and guards are helping them into the shuttle.
Yeah, Anderson seems to like not even notice him when he's in the air duct.
Yeah, it's just really weird. And to me, even the first time I saw this game, the demo of Mass Effect 3 being played, I immediately was like, "There's something wrong with that kid."
Yeah, maybe it's the kid showing up in the dreams.
Yeah. So basically, the idea is that the entire last sequence, once you've gone up to the magical beam of light that Marauder Shields is trying to prevent you from entering.
I just have to say that I love the Marauder Shields meme.
Yeah, I don't necessarily love what people do with Marauder Shields. Like, some of it I just think is super dumb.
Well, say
but,
of course it's
but
super
dumb. I love Marauder Shields so much. For those of you out there who aren't familiar with Marauder Shields, I'd recommend that you go to our website and look at our link. We're going to link you to the Know Your Meme site of Marauder Shields. But basically, he's a Marauder. His health bar displays Marauder and Shields because he has Shields up. And he basically is attempting to prevent you from getting to the ending. He's the last boss of the game. He is a normal Marauder.
Hardy har har.
So, once you get up there, basically, the idea of indoctrination theory is that Shepard, Anderson, and the Elusive Man are sort of having a discussion about how to end this war. And the idea is that this is really happening in Shepard's subconscious, that Anderson represents Shepard's conscience and is attempting to get him to destroy the Reapers, which has been your goal for the entire series of, you know, games. And that the Elusive Man represents the Reaper's will to sort of submit and, you know, basically submit humanity to Reaper control. Of course, if you pass this sort of test and the Elusive Man ends up dying, either you shoot him or he kills himself. I got him to kill himself in my game.
Now, see, you must have been a lot more Paragon than I was.
I was actually mostly Renegade.
Really?
Which I see people saying that you have to play all one way or the other, but I don't play that way. I was about 50-50, and I still got him to kill himself. I've heard people say that it's based on how you do things in the second game. You can get that more easily, or the requirement is more stringent based on how the second game goes. And in the second game, I was mostly Paragon. So that could explain it, but either way, I got the Elusive Man to kill himself. It was very cool. I was super into it. And then, you know, Shepard passed out, got on an elevator, which is basically a meme for Mass Effect. Shitty things happen on elevators. And ended up talking to the technological ghost of this creepy kid from Earth that has been haunting Shepard's dreams.
Which we're thinking is not just any old Reaper, but...
probably Harbinger.
Probably Harby.
Yeah, Harby, as we call him. You know, Harby and Shep have a history. I don't know if you played the Arrival DLC, but Harbinger touches Shepard's mind and knocks him out. Like,
I thought you were going to say he touched something else. I'm like, ooh, scandalous.
Yeah, that would not be pretty. So,
Rule 34.
Rule 34. Yeah, there is probably some Harby X Shep fic out there. And if there isn't, right this moment, there will be once this hits the internet.
Someone is making fan art right now as they're listening to this.
So,
and if you happen to make some, we might put it up on our site. So,
and I don't want to linger too much longer on the mechanics of indoctrination theory, but basically the idea is that Destroy Red is refusing Reaper control.
Which has been your goal the whole time.
Yeah, that, oh yeah, I'm going to destroy the Reapers. We're out.
I was so manipulated by that Star Child that I was like, he was trying to mess with my emotions and be like, oh, then I would kill Edie.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the, sort of the core of indoctrination theory, is that the Star Child, and, you know, the higher effective military strength you have, Star Child's dialogue actually changes. Which is interesting, because I played this game on my laptop in the same room as someone else who was playing on their laptop. And the Star Child told us both different things. My military strength was maxed out, and he downplayed. Like, he definitely tried to not sell me on Destroy. He told me Destroy was terrible, I definitely didn't want to do it. You know, Edie was gonna die. And he told, you know, the other player in the room, Starchild did not sell Destroy as such a bad sale.
Yeah, because my effective military strength wasn't super high, because I was just really trying to get to the ending. And he's like, well, you know, you could do this, but then you're gonna die, and everything else is gonna die.
And then, so the theory goes that the blue control option is the option that he would want you to do, which is basically submitting and becoming a Reaper yourself, is how indoctrination theory goes. That the Reapers would take control of Shepard, use him to sort of get, you know, the Allied military forces to surrender, and then just make new Reapers out of humanity, as was the seeming plan, and go on with their cycle of destruction every 50,000 years.
Lovely.
And that Control is, you know, basically just joining with them yourself, like what Saren wanted in the first game.
I'm sorry, I think you mean Synthesis.
I do mean Synthesis. What did I say?
You said Control.
Oh, goddammit. Yeah, so the green Synthesis is what Saren wanted in the first game. And, you know, joining with them and all that. And again, this ties into what I mentioned earlier, that the best ending that you is the hardest to unlock is the one where you pick Destroy in this scenario, and then wake up back on Earth, breathing. Now, and to touch on your comment about it could be Shepard's last breath, it could be that, except already the Star Child is sort of locked in a lie, because then the red explosion didn't kill you and just passed through you. So, the Star Child tells you that the red explosion will kill synthetics, including you, Shepard. If you're back on Earth after the explosion has passed, obviously, it didn't kill you.
It didn't.
So, Star Child is a big liar, and indoctrination theory basically states that there's a reason why the last portion of the game is so inconsistent.
Now, if this is actually what BioWare's plan has been, talk about a high concept game ending, and, you know, there's a lot of implications here. Did they want to put it in, but EA was like, nope, we want to make more money, we know this franchise makes money, so you're cutting that out and selling it as DLC.
Now, my hope, of course, is that their plan was to do this and to release it as DLC, but to not charge for it, which I know sounds a little like, what, free DLC? But hear me out. I think it's worth mentioning that Mass Effect 2 had free DLC for first-time buyers. It was part of the whole sort of Project $10 initiative that we all just refer to as online passes now. Mass Effect 3 did not have anything like that. And so my thought is, it would be interesting if the reason why the From Ashes DLC, which was the day one DLC for Mass Effect that did not come free with the normal version of the game, it would be interesting to me if the reason that wasn't the free DLC is because the free DLC was being reserved for sort of the true ending, to reveal to us, hopefully, that indoctrination theory is correct, and that the last game is not a clusterfuck on accident, but on purpose, so that we would all know that that wasn't really it.
I mean, I can't see how people are so narrow-minded that they're like, no, it's just shitty writing. Like, I mean, yes, maybe there is a possibility that it's shitty writing, and, I mean, for me, that honestly just means that there's been a great franchise, and then, okay, so the ending kind of didn't make sense. Yeah. How many other franchises have had disappointing endings?
Oh, I would dare say more often
Lord
than
of the Rings. Oh, bye, Frodo. Bye. And if you didn't didn't know the ending of Lord of the Rings, welcome to either the early 2000s or, like, decades before that, because you know the books.
Yeah.
So, I mean, lots of...
The ending has...
Nobody's going to be happy, even if indoctrination theory is proven true.
Yeah.
People are still going to be pissed.
And, you know, the ending as it stands, it's... I don't think it's that bad. If that ending is to be taken at face value, I'm not going to suddenly hate the other 99% of this amazing franchise. I've gotten hundreds of hours out of this franchise now. I don't suddenly feel that they've all been worthless. They've all been amazing experiences. And then they didn't nail the ending. It's like when you see a gymnast in the Olympics and most of their routine is flawless and they don't nail the ending. It doesn't invalidate the entire performance. You just knock a couple points off the score.
It does mean that in future playthroughs, I might be a dick to Joe for those. Because what a coward if that's the case.
Yeah, if this ending is as it stands, I have a bigger problem with the fact that my crew left me up to deal with Star Child and they flew off to some fucking Planet Eden bullshit.
Where, how are half of your crew, if certain people live? I mean, this is all very dependent on, maybe that's the multiple endings, like, oh, maybe you have Garrus in your party, or maybe you don't, because who knows what happened in 2 if you were not stupid, or if you were. So maybe that's their idea of multiple endings, like, ooh, maybe
yeah.
What happens is, Tally killed herself, so you don't have to worry about the fact that this planet might not be able to sustain Corian life.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point.
But I do not think that's the case. I seriously think that, this is kind of where I'm at. I think that the more that I'm thinking about this and reflecting about this, that I don't think BioWare was trying to pull one over on us. I think they really just wanted to do this high concept ending, and they were hoping that gamers would be able to, and I mean, some people are being civil about it, but they're still being like, wah, 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 wah. So, I mean, I don't know. There's still so much, and we'll talk about fan reaction and BioWare's actions as a result of that, but I mean, I think personally, and I mean, I don't know people who work at BioWare, I don't know the development team, so I mean, I'm just speculating here. I think that BioWare was hoping that people would be like, whoa, that's Dark Child's Light. I mean, I imagine that they didn't expect people to figure out indoctrination so fast, but be like, hey, something's up.
Well, and you know, on that point as well, it's worth mentioning that BioWare, quite famously, in fact, severely underestimated how long it would take players to reach max level in the Old Republic, Star Wars. So it has occurred to me, you know, that maybe they truly didn't realize people were going to finish Mass Effect 3 the day it came out. And get the best ending and figure out indoctrination within days of its release. Maybe they didn't understand. Maybe they continue to underestimate
how
dedicated their fan base is.
How rabid this fan base is. Yeah, maybe so. And I mean, I think maybe their hope was that, oh, you know, we want them to start piecing it together, but they just didn't realize how hardcore their fan base is. That kind of maybe came back to bite them in the ass.
Yeah, and so this, of course, is a topic that we're going to have to come back to on a little bit. One way or another, BioWare has stated that we're going to get additional content for this game.
New content initiatives is the
yes.
term that they're using.
I think most of
to
us...
To clarify the ending, I was really surprised, and I mean, I'm pretty sure that we're going to be talking about this quite often on Game Buoy. And I mean, a lot of this, what I've seen, was just in the general mainstream media, but even in some gaming journalism, referring to it as BioWare is rewriting the ending. No, they're not rewriting the ending, they're clarifying. And that to me is a sign that, oh, hey, well, something's up. They're not just going to be like, oh, that didn't happen, it's not some End of Evangelion rewrite.
Well, you know, I do have some amount of concern, of course, that they are rewriting the ending. I don't believe that's happening. But, you know, there are all of these fan campaigns and fan protests about changing the ending and reclaiming the ending, so...
Yeah, they're taking that, the marketing thing of Retake Earth, or Take Earth Back, which was kind of, you know, the slogan for Mass Effect 3, because that's what you're trying to do, you're trying to retake Earth. They're like, retake Mass Effect 3. And, you know, I think more so than whether or not BioWare's had this plan all along, or if they're going to be like, oh, well, you know, we better run with this and cover our asses, I think more significant is how much power should the fans have in controlling this? What does that say about the audience involvement in the development of gaming?
Well, yeah, I almost feel like this is a potentially a watershed moment for role-playing games in sort of this point in the industry's lifespan, because ultimately the fandom and the interaction between the content creators and the content consumers is potentially about to change wildly if BioWare
right.
does cave and change their plan.
I would say that until this point, if that's what's going to happen, the only other company I can think of that had really that level of involvement and input from their fans was Blizzard, probably. Blizzard has always been a...
Yeah, and typically Blizzard's products are treated as sort of living in progress works. You know,
which
see,
is different because, I mean, it's an MMO.
Well, I'm even thinking towards stuff like Diablo 2, which has gotten content patches and updates as recently as just like a year ago. You know, and they've always taken a lot of feedback and tried to tune the game to be balanced and remain fun and engaging. This is a little different to me because this is potentially changing the fundamental vision of how your story is concluding. And I don't think there's precedent for that. I think this is unprecedented. And I have to say, frankly, I'm not ready to sort of cross that. I don't know that that's a paradigm that needs to shift yet. I'm not ready to cross that Rubicon.
Yeah, I mean, I just had thinking of, I was so disappointed at the ending of Ocarina in Time, and okay, warning, if you are about to be spoiled about the ending of Ocarina of Time, why haven't you played it yet?
It's your own damn fault.
If you haven't played Ocarina of Time and you're listening to this podcast, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But that'd be like the fan base being like, oh, that ending was shitty, he traveled back in time. Back to being Kid Link, and then Majora's Mask is a shit fest. I love Majora's Mask, by the way, so...
I was about to reach over and slap
it, girl. I'm saying, but there are people who hate it. So, I mean, if people reacted that way, Nintendo's like, okay, send your carts back. Because, I mean, there's not going to be patches for N64. I mean, we didn't even get the 64DD every year. So, I mean, they'll be like, okay, send your carts back, and here's
Link, a new ending!
Here's Link and Zelda getting married. I mean, that's the type of precedent we're really talking about, and I mean, maybe not so much. I mean, people, yes, they're saying, oh, my choices didn't matter, but it's ultimately been BioWare's story to tell.
And I'm eager to see what they're going to do with it, but I do dearly, deeply hope that they're not changing anything because of this.
Because that's kind of just, like, bending to the fans' whim, and I mean, a company that is as big as BioWare. I mean, you know, I know BioWare gets shit on a lot, especially by, like, the 4chan community. And, I mean, probably even Reddit, because they just want to do whatever 4chan does, but, I mean, we know that, yeah, BioWare gets shit on a lot. Probably a lot of it's unfair. I mean, even if there is maybe a little bit of validity in it, but I think it's setting a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, and that's my concern here, really, is the precedent being set.
Are fans becoming too entitled?
Yeah. Yeah, it's heavy stuff.
And I mean, this combined with some of the things we started to talk about with Sega, that's, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns, and you know, we'll explore this in coming episodes.
Yes, we're kind of in rough waters here to keep with our pirate theme, so we're going to navigate you, we're going to be your buoy, your game buoy in the ocean of the gaming world. I'm sorry, that metaphor was terrible, but...
Yeah, it's all right. We're all guilty of one once in a while. So, to wrap up this segment, I just want to say we know BioWare is going to do something. We know this isn't the end. And I think right now all eyes are on the Mass Effect panel at PAX next weekend.
Right.
So we may have an update for you on this in our next episode.
I have two quick questions for you. First, do you think that... because people are saying, oh, you know, they might just run with it now. Do you think that... I mean, even if they did that, would we ever really know that it wasn't their plan all along? They could just say, like, yep, that was our plan...
I hope if they do adopt indoctrination theory and it wasn't their plan in the first place, at the very least, I hope they never let us know that.
I mean, do you think that people are going to be like, oh no, well, it took you 5 months to do it, so obviously you were copying our theory?
Well, you know, I know that that sentiment will be unbound, but if they can get it out and it is only a matter of months, well, you know. Polished game content takes a long time to put together. There is an expectation from gamers these days that content should be ready super fast, you know, despite the fact that these are the same people that decry day one DLC and, oh, it should be on the disc free of charge. The way development budgets work and time constraints work, that's just not a realistic thing. They could have been working on indoctrination theory post-game content for months now, and it could still well not be ready for months. The best I think that we could hope for, if they have had this in mind all along, is that they have some kind of assets to show us at PAX next weekend. That would really be the easiest way to just confirm, oh, this was the plan all along. But even if we don't see anything for a while, that's not really conclusive one way or another.
You know, I'm that kind of leads to my second question. I feel this just makes me kind of excited to see how it's going to continue. I'm not like, oh, they're just going to gouge us with any DLC. I'm glad I don't have to say goodbye to Shepard yet. How do you feel about it?
I'll be honest. I have very strong feelings on DLC in general. It's why we're probably going to do an episode on all things digital in the
future.
And
you're going to have to pay $10 to download it.
Oh,
just kidding.
That'll work out super well. But, you know, my feeling is typically, if you enjoyed a game, you want more content, buy it and enjoy more content. And if you didn't enjoy a game, or you were left unhappy...
then save your money.
Save your money.
Buy some Skittles.
Yeah, go...
Okay, wait, that might actually not be okay to say.
Not funny! So, but, you know, again... no one's making you buy more content. If you're unhappy with Mass Effect and the ending DLC is too much money for you, then just accept that you don't like it and move on, I guess.
And I think the last thing I have to say about
I will
this,
say, I do hope that that ending is, as I mentioned, part of the online pass. I do view that as ideal.
Yes.
But, again, this franchise and this game specifically, some of the best experiences I've had this console generation.
I mean, you know,
I'm gonna pay $10 if that's what it takes.
Yeah, same here. And I mean, I just think if this is true, what a high concept ending.
Truly,
and I mean,
truly, truly, truly outrageous.
Really is, and you know, I think the last thing I have to say is that some people who are just really taking it to a extreme place are like, oh well, BioWare's going out of business now. They've fucked themselves in the ass. No, they haven't.
I just want to say, you know...
if they recovered from Dragon Age 2, which got a lot of hate...
yeah, that was a shit show. And I like Dragon Age 2. I'm not as much as I like the first one.
I don't think BioWare's quite shot themselves in the foot. They've got some damage control to do, but who doesn't have a little damage control on them? So, wow, it's really... it feels like a really heavy show today. So,
yeah.
I don't know about you, but I feel like I need a little bit of a lull.
I'm happy you said that. Because as it so happens, it's time for...
So, what do you have in store for us today?
So, did you see this article? I guess they ran it on the 30th. And this was titled, "The Reasons So Many Japanese RPGs Never Make It to the United States."
Oh, well, since we're dealing with Kotaku, or as we like to call it, Waltaku, I'm sure this is going to be a very well-researched piece of gaming journalism.
Yeah, and you know, it's part of their random encounters column,
which sounds like a section on Craigslist.
Yeah, right, it's M4M, random encounters. You know, I don't want to bash this column too much. I am a huge fan and supporter of JRPGs. They're probably my favorite type of game. So I like the idea that there's a column that you know, theoretically, serves people like me. My problem is that it's poorly researched.
It's Kotaku, what do you expect?
And further, so they talk to Vic Ireland, who I have nothing but respect for. You know, he frequently posts on forums online. He stays in touch with sort of the fan base, and he knows the kinds of consumers that are still buying these games. I know that a lot of people very much dislike Vic Ireland for what Working Designs, his studio in the old days, for what they did to JRPGs when they were bringing them over. They would give them sort of irreverent translations that were really funny. They would dub songs. But, you know, they also did, they basically made deluxe editions of games a real viability. Prior to, you know, like the Lunar games they did, where they had like hardbound manuals and cloth maps and bizarre like punching bag marionette things. Like, prior to that, you just bought your game and it came in a clamshell box or a jewel case, and that was it. Like, there was no fancy packaging, there was nothing special. So he did, I thought that he, and specifically Working Designs, they did some really amazing things for the industry, and for people who, like us, really love and respect this medium.
Like, I don't think without those crazy sets you would have, like, Assassin's Creed with Ezio statue or whatever, you know?
No, or that amazing Deus Ex Play Arts figure of Adam Jensen. Like, that is, like, the coolest thing I've ever seen, and it would not have existed if not for these sort of earlier permutations.
I remember those Lunar, the full-page advertisement. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
It's like a 4-CD soundtrack, and, I mean...
Yeah, so, you know, it's cool, this article, it's cool. They talk to him a little bit. They actually ask one hard-hitting question that I thought was really worthwhile. The game... The topic of this post, basically, ostensibly, is that Vic Ireland, with Monkey Paw Games, and is it Gaijin Works that he's with these days?
Yes, he's with Gaijin Works.
Excellent. They're kickstartering a deluxe package for Class of Heroes 2. And I actually appreciate that Laltaku asked him, why are you attaching this to Class of Heroes 2? The first game was ass. And Vic Ireland basically says, because right now Japanese producers, developers, publishers, they don't want to release games in the US, even if they're going to be a moderate success, basically because of what the industry looks like, the marketplace looks like over here. They don't want to have a failure on their hands and lose face. They want to remain in a position where the games they do bring over do well. And so Vic Ireland is basically trying to make the argument, we're going to do this Kickstarter to release this deluxe edition of Class of Heroes 2, and thus raise $500,000 to show the Japanese game industry that America wants your games. That's a good thing. And
yeah,
Kotaku,
we kind of had a little of that with Nintendo and the JRPG fan base.
Oh yeah, well, back with Project Rainfall, you know, the best JRPG of the generation is coming to America, I think, in the next week.
Yeah.
And it is largely because of this sort of reaction. And Kotaku is basically like, why are you doing this with Class of Heroes 2? The first game was ass. And Vic is like, oh, well, kinda yeah, but it's better than the first game, and more importantly, it needs to happen. Some game needs to be sort of the masthead, to move this forward, because we're losing games left and right here. The industry is not in a super viable place right now. We need to start getting some games that sort of these niche fan bases want, because right now there are entire sectors of the market, of which I consider myself a part, we're not really being served right now.
Right.
So,
but it's Kotaku, so...
And then Kotaku is just like, yeah, well, we don't think it's going to meet the goal. It's a shame because we want new stuff, but whatever.
Now, when they said like the reason that JRPGs don't sell, I just remember reading it and being like, wow, that's just really shitty writing.
Yeah, well, it's Kotaku.
Can I get a quote? Can I get a quote from that? Just so our listeners can get a...
Feeling screwed? If you're an American fan of Japanese games, you certainly should be. Publishers in the East have not treated us very well over the past few decades. They have given us rushed and incomplete localizations. Often, they don't send us North American ports at all. Sometimes, it feels like Japanese game makers just don't want us to play their games. From Nintendo's Mother 3 to Sega's Valkyria Chronicles 3 to countless ports and remakes on the PlayStation Network and other platforms, there are a whole lot of great Japanese role-playing games that most U.S. fans have never had the chance to play.
And this is all true, but it sounds like it was written by a seventh grader for their school newspaper.
Well, and you know, it's really...
Are you feeling screwed by the Japanese gaming industry?
And you know, even more than that, it's really deceptive to use Mother 3 and Valkyria Chronicles 3 as examples. Because, you know, Mother 3, it's been long theorized and confirmed unofficially that the reason Mother 3 never came to the U.S. is because changes would have to be made for it to be released legally because of music assets and art assets in the game that would be borderline copyright infringement in the U.S. going by U.S. law. So, you know, it certainly sucks that, you know, they don't want to alter the game's artistic direction for legal reasons to make it a viable release in the U.S., but at the same time, I have a certain level of respect for that, and I always have.
They're trying to screw you.
And Valkyria Chronicles 3 hasn't been brought to the U.S. because Valkyria Chronicles 2 was released to the U.S. and sold poorly, and Sega lost money on it.
But if you're just someone reading Kotaku, or Waltaku, then you're just gonna be like, oh, JRPGs,
don't
come
here,
because they're trying to screw us.
Because the Japanese are trying to screw us.
And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to brag, but just by listening to what Captain Spike just said, you got more information than you did from Otaku.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, again, everything I'm saying you can source to, you know, the Mother fan base. They have some really great web resources that we'll link you to on our website. And Valkyria Chronicles 2 sales were, you know, reported, or not, by the NPD. And I say not because, you know, they only track platform titles, or software titles, that sell over a certain number. And Valkyria Chronicles 2 did not sell within that range. Like, I'm sorry, it's sad to think about or whatever, but if a game doesn't sell well, why would they bring the sequel over to the U.S. to also fail? And again, I love Valkyria Chronicles. I love Valkyria Chronicles 2. I own both of them. Given everything that's going on with Sega, especially right now, I can't really fault them for wanting to take a hit on Valkyria Chronicles 3.
Yeah.
And it really upsets me that this exact post could have happened with just the names of other JRPGs thrown in there. Ones that actually we don't have legitimate reasons for not coming here. Stuff like Sands of Destruction, which was actually localized for U.S. release and then just never released. Stuff like the Suikoden 1 and 2 pack for PSP. That would have been great. And, you know, Suikoden 2 is a well-sought-after game. Used sales of that game on eBay typically go for, you know, more than $150 per copy because it's a great game that people want. So why you wouldn't release a port of that in the U.S., of that re-release in the U.S., I don't get it. And that, to me, is the kind of thing that Kotaku could be using their platform to discuss, rather than sort of this whole thing where, like, we already know why these games didn't come to the U.S.
Because they're trying to screw us. Thanks, so, Otaku. Some quality writing from you.
So, that is our...
I'm sure that aside from Waltaku lols, that we're going to be having some things to say about journalism.
We're not going to beat up just on Kotaku here. You know, I think Kotaku has done some really good things over the years. It's easy to beat up on them because they're so large and because they do run at quite a few stories of dubious quality. But I do want to say that there was a long stretch of time where I felt like they were pretty much the only ones with anything legit to say.
Yeah, because, I mean, or you could go to IGN, and who wants to do that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. You can't spell ignorant without IGN.
It's all too true.
So, that about wraps it up for us this week. I want to give just a brief shout-out to Geeks for Fans. I know they're not around anymore. Hopefully they'll come back someday.
Wicked over on the Nerdgasm Network.
On
their gaming podcast. So I'm glad that he's found a new home, even if he is just there temporarily before Grim Rackets for Fans. You know, we've got to thank him for letting us set sail from his port.
Yep. And, you know, Slagkick has a podcast that he runs, Fabulous Flames. They're focused on the World of Warcraft.
Yeah, so if you're into listening to super gay stuff about World of Warcraft, check us out. FabulousFlames.com.
And, you know, always, of course, we take great influence from our friends over at Orange Lounge Radio and the Best Little Horde House in Azeroth. So, you know, good on them. Definitely worth a listen. Some other podcasts. We'll have some links for you guys on our website over at GameBuoy.org. That's .org, not .arg, which I accidentally did.
You typed .arg?
Yeah. It was nothing, obviously, but...
Now, was it just a serendipitous typo, or were you trying to...
No, I had hoped that you had nailed arg as
a domain. I don't think that's a domain yet, but it should be.
It really should be. Of course, if you have any questions, concerns, you just want to give us some feedback on the topics we discussed today, feel free to hit us up, GameBuoy, on Facebook. We also have a Twitter...
Our Twitter is GameBuoy Podcast because some fuck took GameBuoy and then never tweeted. I would be okay if he tweeted, but he never tweeted, so I'm like, eh. So maybe one day we can retake GameBuoy Twitter. Hashtag it. We'll start a campaign. But yeah, please do so. You can email either of us as well if you want to email. Captain Spike is cpt.spike@gamebuoy.org and I'm slidekick@gamebuoy.org. And I mean, if you are visiting our site, then we'll have email links up there, so kind of you should be emailing us and saying hi. And we want to know, what do you think about Mass Effect 3? What do you think about Sega? We want you to be involved in our journey together. So
yep, and I think that just about wraps it up. Thank you all for your time out there in Internet Radio Land. I know you have a lot of podcast options. We really appreciate that you went with us. For Mass Effect 3's ending, this is Captain Spike
and his first mate Slagkick.
Be well, and we'll see you next time.